Well, Daniel chapter 5, moving right through this book, and this was exciting preparation for me. I worked a little harder than normal to try to get you all some handouts, two extra biblical. Anytime you can get an extra biblical source on something to validate the biblical source, it's just a wonderful thing. Do we need it to validate the Bible? No, because the Bible is the inspired Word of God, and for us, we accept it. We don't need any extra sources, but it sure is nice when there's some floating around out there. And for our message today, the lesson today, we're going to look at two extra biblical sources that support what happens here in chapter 5, and it's history that was recorded about these events. But you remember last week we looked at the humbling of Nebuchadnezzar, 7 years out in one of the royal the garden off the royal palace. And at the end of that, what was the reason he spent 7 years out in his garden acting like a lion, wasn't he? It was divine judgment from God. What was the reason? Pride. And what did God want to teach him? What's the key theme written in every chapter of this book?
Sovereignty of God, that he's in control.
Who's in control? The sovereignty of God is on every page. And these opening chapters show us that God raises up these Gentile kings, and he takes them out when he's done with them. And that's what chapter 5 is going to be all about, is Nebuchadnezzar ends up at the end of his life giving praise to the God of heaven, which this beautiful Daniel 4:37, where he says, "I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and exalt and glorify the King of heaven, because everything he does is right, and all his ways are just. And those who walk in pride, he is able to humble. Let me tell you about it." And that's basically what chapter 4 is all about, isn't it? He recounts what had happened to him and how he was so prideful. God tried to get him to confess that sin and to quit it, and he refused to do it. And what I love about God as I read through different chapters like this is he gave him a whole year to get over it, and he wouldn't do it. And so one day he was out looking at his palace that he had built, just bragging on himself, and a voice out of heaven said, "Today's the day. You've had it." Oh, man, what a bummer. And immediately he was struck with madness and put out into one of the royal, probably off the palace, into a garden. And he stayed out there living like an animal for 7 years until the end of that time. Then his reason was restored. His kingdom was restored. Everything was restored unto him. And we saw that he ended up that chapter exalting and praising God, who is able to humble those who walk in pride. So the message for us was, let's not be walking in pride. Anything we have, anything that God blesses us with, it's so that we might praise him and tell others about his goodness and invite them to come on board.
Question.
Yes, sir.
Clarify one thing. At the beginning of chapter 5 starts with King Belshazzar.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Daniel is known as Belshazzar. Is this also Nebuchadnezzar?
No, this is his. We're going to see this as a grandson.
Okay.
And different, a little bit different name.
Good to know going in. Okay.
Yeah. Chapter 5 is about, we call this Belshazzar's blasphemous feast. Exalted, filled with pride and arrogance, young whippersnapper. His dad is Nabonidus, which is a son of Nebuchadnezzar. And it seems that Nabonidus was off. Out of Babylon, he was out conquering down and around Arabia, kind of built himself a summer palace down there, and he liked it down there. So he stayed down there, and he left his son Belshazzar in charge, and he's just filled with pride and arrogance. And at this time in history, the Persians are, the Medes and the Persians have kind of teamed up under this fellow that we've studied before in the book of Isaiah, who became the king of the Medes and the Persians and conquered Babylon and became second world ruler.
Cyrus,
the king of Persia. And so Cyrus rises to power. Both Nabonidus and Belshazzar try to do battle against him, but he's the mighty bear, isn't he? He just keeps rolling on. And so he's coming after him. Belshazzar went out and tried to defeat him, not too far from Babylon, and got whipped. So he ran back home, locked himself in the palace, and had a big party. And so he just partied for months, and he invited thousands to surround himself with all his royalty and dignitaries and telling himself how great he is, how mighty he is. Sounds like pride to me, doesn't it? And he now, in this chapter, will be debased, as we shall see. So Belshazzar the king held a great feast for 1,000 of his nobles, and he was drinking wine in the presence of the thousands. When Belshazzar tasted the wine, he gave orders to bring the gold and silver vessels which Nebuchadnezzar his father had taken out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem, in order that his kings and nobles, his wives, his concubines, might drink from them. Then they brought the gold vessels that had been taken out of the temple, the house of God, which was in Jerusalem, and the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines, they all drank from them. They drank the wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. So this is a direct affront to the living God, to the true God. And they took vessels that were used in the priestly services that his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple when he took Jerusalem. And there was three times that he took them, 605, 597, and then ultimately in 586, he destroyed the temple and drug them all away, didn't he? As we've already seen. And so he calls for these, he gets juiced up and drunk and calls for all these vessels to be brought in so everyone can drink from them. The ultimate, to me, blasphemy against the living God. Well, this fellow Belshazzar, for most of history, there was no record of him. And so in the 1800s, the liberal critics really attacked this chapter and said that there's no record of any Belshazzar in history. Well, interestingly, we've unearthed records about Belshazzar, and the fact is that he was the son of Nabonidus, who was a direct son of, we believe, Nebuchadnezzar. The record is that in 562, Nebuchadnezzar died. And then there was a steady weakening of his regime, where his successor was Amel Marduk, or the evil Merodach of 2 Kings 25:27. And he ruled only 2 years and was replaced in 560 by a commander by the name of Nergal-Sharezer, the Nergal-Sharezer of Jeremiah 39:3, who was the son-in-law of Nebuchadnezzar, so it's still somewhat in the family. And after frequent absences from active service, it sounds like he went on lots of vacations, and he was in turn ousted, and his weak son, Labashi Marduk, lasted only a few months before he was taken out by Nabonidus. And Nabonidus is, we believe, the son of Nebuchadnezzar, or he may have been a son-in-law. He may have married the queen mother. We're not real sure. History isn't really clear on it. We have the succession, we have the names, but how they all fit, we aren't sure, because you see where it says here that Belshazzar was Nebuchadnezzar's son, Nebuchadnezzar his father, there in verse 2. The term is used for father, son, or grandson, or great-grandson. The same term is used of the line of succession. So we aren't sure. And the best that scholars have done with this, with the finding of these new documents, naming Nebuchadnezzar and Nabonidus and Belshazzar, you notice that we're going to see here in a minute, for those of you that have studied this before, when Belshazzar, when this handwriting on the wall appears, he calls for someone to interpret it. Nobody can interpret it. Kind of reminds us of the earlier dreams of Nebuchadnezzar, doesn't it? Until they bring Daniel in. And they end up bringing Daniel in because the queen mother comes in, who seems to be the mother or grandmother of Belshazzar here, probably the grandmother, and she tells him about Daniel, and he brings Daniel in, and he says to him, if you can read this interpretation, I'm going to give you all these presents and make you what ruler in the kingdom? Third ruler in the kingdom. Why third ruler?
His dad's real ruler.
His dad Nabonidus is the ruler. He's co-regent, or co-ruling with his dad, who's away. He's in Babylon, the capital. So Belshazzar is the son of Nabonidus, who is the true king. He's the co-regent, ruling with his dad, and he says he's going to make Daniel the third ruler in the kingdom.
Question.
Yes.
Yeah, is Daniel then goes through, what, three generations?
Mm-hmm.
Nebuchadnezzar,
all these other rulers, but he was probably put off to the side as he was here.
Because he went to Cyrus too, you know.
Well, he was talking about under the Babylonian regime. And I was just going to say, he would have went through all of these that we mentioned. And it seems like he's, after Nebuchadnezzar, from what we understand or know, he's not seen again until here in chapter 5. And what is being emphasized in chapter 5 is he's been set aside. Belshazzar doesn't even know him. Nabonidus, we have no record that Nabonidus acknowledged him or had any interactions with him. So it seems like he's kind of in his palace and he's got his his senatorial retirement or whatever. And life's good. He's just worshiping the Lord and things are moving on until this night. And then he's brought in. And then as we will see in chapter 6, Cyrus comes in. And I'm sure Daniel shared with him the portions out of Isaiah that, do you remember where that is? Where Cyrus is prophesied 150 years earlier, before he's ever born. It's prophesied through Isaiah the prophet that a ruler would arise by the name of Cyrus and he would set God's people free from captivity and return them to their homeland. Does anybody remember in Isaiah 45? The very end of 44, his name is prophesied, and then 45, God prophesies that he would be his servant, his anointed one, his Messiah, his deliverer. He foreshadows somewhat of Jesus Christ. So that's who this individual is. Belshazzar, son of Nabonidus. Nabonidus, we believe, son of or related to Nebuchadnezzar. But it's interesting that Nebuchadnezzar there at the end of chapter 4, he's just out of there after he exalts God. It's like God says, okay, in 562, he dies. Come on home. I personally think he's in heaven. Others disagree. He's one of those on my list I'm going to be looking for when I get there to see if he's there. Why wouldn't he be there? He exalts the God of heaven. He gives praise to the God of heaven. How about Cyrus? Do you remember from our study of Isaiah?
I believe Cyrus decided not to. He had many gods, I think.
Yeah. Remember Cyrus? God said, I'm going to use him and raise him up, speaking prophetically about him coming on the scene. Even though you don't know me, you don't know me. It's repeated throughout chapter 45 of Isaiah, isn't it? Did he come to know him in the end? I don't know. We have no record of it. Nebuchadnezzar, I could put some money on him, though, I think. Cyrus, I don't know. We'll look for him, too. Because what's necessary for us to get in? Acknowledge we have a need. Repent. We're sinners. God says I'm a sinner. I accept that. I'm a sinner. Forgive me and help me to discover the salvation you have for me. And for us, that's Christ, of course. We have the finished revelation. So this is Belshazzar's feast here, the handwriting on the wall. Suddenly the fingers, well, I'll save that till I, let me back up. Sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. Too excited this morning. Any question on that first section? They're having a giant party. He's surrounded, the walls outside, he's surrounded by the Persian army. There's no way in. Or so he thought. There's no way in. Let's just party. So they're having this drunken feast, and he gets to the point in his drunkenness where he orders the vessels of the house of God, the temple in Jerusalem that his father, grandfather, Nebuchadnezzar had destroyed and brought back. They had them there, probably in their temple, and drug those in there and started drinking from them, his wives and his concubines, all of them. And they were praising their idols, verse 4. They were drinking wine and praising and toasting their gods, gods of gold and silver, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. So the palace would have been filled, this dining hall would have been filled with idols that were carved to the prestige and to the glory of Belshazzar and the Babylonian kingdom. So now we have God's contribution to the feast, the handwriting on the wall. Suddenly the fingers of a man's hand emerged and began writing opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the back of the hand that did the writing. Then the king's face grew pale and his thoughts alarmed him. His hip joints went slack and his knees began knocking together. Scared the pajunis out of him, right? He was scared to death. This is the king. He's supposed to be the exalted ruler. How come he's so freaked out? Because a hand shows up on the wall, being reflected by the lamp, as you can see in the drawing here, and begins to write. And sees his hand write this script, and fills him full of fear. His hip joints went slack. His knees began to knock together. What a great picture. Have you ever been that scared? I've been scared. I mean, I have been really scared before. I don't know if I've ever been that scared. I mean, we're talking totally terror-stricken. His knees knocking together. What's that sound like? Just trembling, visibly shaken. Daniel's contribution to the feast. The king called aloud, "Bring in my conjurers, the Chaldeans, the diviners." And the king spoke and said to the wise men of Babylon, "Any man who can read this inscription and explain its interpretation to me will be clothed with purple and have a necklace of gold around his neck and have authority," here it is, "as third ruler in the kingdom." Nabonidus, Belshazzar, and whoever can read this will be the third ruler. Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the inscription or make known its interpretation to the king. Then King Belshazzar was greatly alarmed. His face, so this guy's getting even more upset. His face grew even paler, and his nobles were perplexed. And then the queen entered the banquet hall because of the words of the king and his nobles. And the queen spoke and said, "O king, live forever," or at least for the night, into the evening. "Do not let your thoughts alarm you or your face be so pale. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is a spirit of the holy gods. And in the days of your father," and again, grandfather here, "illumination, insight, and wisdom like the wisdom of the gods were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father, grandfather, your grandfather the king, appointed him chief of the magicians, conjurers, Chaldeans, and diviners. This was because an extraordinary spirit, knowledge and insight, interpretation of dreams, explanation of enigmas, and solving of difficult problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belshazzar. Let Daniel now be summoned, and he will declare the interpretation." Do you remember what we said last week? That Nebuchadnezzar called Daniel back in Daniel chapter 4, verse 5. He called him chief of the magicians, and that phrase literally in Hebrew or Aramaic, it's the same, headwiser. And that's before they had Budweiser, right? He was the headwiser. He was the wisest of all. He was the head of the wise men. And so now here the queen mother, she's kind of giving him a little bit of a reprimand here, I think, in telling him all about Daniel. Why wasn't Daniel there? Why wasn't he ruling in righteousness like his grandfather did? And certainly we have no record of Nabonidus, just wanted to go out and fight and conquer. So he wasn't even like Nebuchadnezzar either. There's no mention of him in the biblical pages. The only mention is of the grandson Belshazzar. And what happened here? How'd they get short-circuited? How come Nebuchadnezzar didn't have his kids learning from Daniel? We know that Daniel founded a school of the prophets, don't we? Who were the wise men that came from out of the east at the birth of Jesus and were amazed at Herod and the religious rulers for not going down to Bethlehem where the prophecy said he'd be born? Where'd those wise men come from? We believe from out of the school of Daniel and out of this realm. But here he has nothing to do with him, but the queen calls to his attention this head wiser that served your grandfather. He has an extraordinary spirit in him. He can tell dreams. He can interpret omens. Let him be called for. Verse 13, so then they brought Daniel in before the king. And the king spoke and said to Daniel, "Are you that Daniel who is one of the exiles from Judah, whom my father the king brought from Judah? Now I have heard about you that a spirit of the gods is in you, and that illumination, insight, and extraordinary wisdom have been found in you. Just now the wise men and the conjurers were brought in before me that they might read this inscription and make its interpretation known to me, but they could not declare the interpretation of the message." So they could not declare, so they're supposed to come in and make the inscription known, but they could not declare the interpretation. So it seems like maybe they understood the inscription, but they didn't know what it meant. It was like a riddle, and they couldn't understand it. And so here he's emphasizing the fact that they couldn't declare the interpretation of the message. "But I personally have heard about you," 5 minutes ago from my grandma. You know, why didn't you check him out before? And maybe he had heard about him before. Maybe even as a youth, his dad or grandpa tried to have him in there to get some lessons from Daniel, from the headwiser, to help him get his head screwed on straight. Didn't want to fool with that. He's too filled with pride and arrogance to hear anything that God would have to say or to hear godly wisdom. But I personally have heard about you, verse 16, that you were able to give interpretations and solve difficult problems. Now, if you were able to read the inscription and make its interpretation known to me, you will be clothed with purple and wear a necklace of gold around your neck, and you will have authority as the third ruler in the kingdom. Then Daniel answered and said before the king, keep your gifts for yourself or give your rewards to someone else. I don't have any need of it. Just keep it. I don't want it to be said in history that I accepted anything from you or did anything.
It didn't get to be third very long, was
it? No, it wasn't. Not in this kingdom, anyway.
It's going to be a long duration.
It's going to be made number two here pretty quick in a new kingdom. And keep in mind as you put these chapters together, those that are wise, why are they called wise? Why biblically would you be called a wise man according to the wisdom literature in the Bible? Go ahead, Pat.
Because they were inspired by God of understanding.
They were seeking, or they would seek their Creator God. Today, each of you would be called a wise man if you have accepted Jesus Christ as your Savior and read His Word daily and try to live it. That's a wise man. That's the biblical definition of a wise man. It's F-O-L, fear of the Lord. Fear of the Lord is a wise man in the wisdom literature of the Bible. There's a number of books in a collection called the wisdom literature. What do they emphasize over and over and over again? F-O-L, fear of the Lord. And what does fear of the Lord do? It studies about God. It tries to live for God. It asks God for help to live for God. Because we don't have good days every day. We need the Lord to help us. And that is what these kings here don't seem to do. Cyrus, when he comes to town, does he really fear the Lord? Not necessarily, but his policies are in keeping with the Lord. And God had prophesied that he would use him in that way before he was ever born, 150 years before he comes on the scene. Isaiah prophesies there in Isaiah 44 and 45 that this one named Cyrus would arise to power and restore God's people, and he would pay for it out of the royal treasury to rebuild it all. So God uses these rulers. What's that all about again? Sovereignty. Who is in charge? And we here in this country for many years now, we think we're in charge. We're the mightiest. Oh, get out of here. We are so far bankrupted. And when are the World Bank and our creditors going to call our notes due? We can't even pay the interest anymore, can we, Jeff? It's just snowballing into trillions.
Big
warm?
Right. Like a third of the national debt or something.
Oh. And all of us just paid our taxes yesterday, didn't we? We won't even make a dent in it. They're going to have to borrow billions, trillions to just keep the thing going. We have no will anymore. Even all the, I just watch, I don't know, I can't think globally, so I try to think, you know, domestically here, just in Missouri. But on every time that the taxes come up anymore, what do they got? They got multi-million-dollar bonds stuck in there, and they're really working the people. And it's usually the women are doing this. They're working all the other women, so they'll work their husbands so that they'll all vote yes on these bonds to do what? To build these giant computer labs and gymnasiums and all the stuff for the kids. We got to help the kids. Now, don't even get me started.
Stem cell research.
Yeah, all this good stuff. But there's no conscience anymore. They just keep building and debt and building and debt and... It wasn't that way not too many years ago when we were kids. Do you remember back? Well, for me, I'm older than some of you. Some of us remember. Our parents, or even us, when we bought our first house, you had to have 20% in real money and another 20, 30% in the bank that you're borrowing the note to get the house. And you had to have a job that, you know, was signed off on, or they wouldn't loan you the money on the house. Today, you watched that report last Friday on the news? That there's more foreclosures. The housing industry right now is in worse shape than since the Great Depression. Can you imagine a statement like that? How'd we get in this shape? Well, because I think our President Bush assumed a White House that was bankrupted from the former administration. And he said, well, print more money, get more money, get money in the economy, keep her going. Give them cheap money and everybody will be happy. And man, have we been happy. They've been buying like crazy. Do you know the average American family, and I don't know if this is you, hopefully not, we're wiser. We're Budweisers, right? We're wiser than the rest. They have 10 credit cards. And those 10 credit cards have $8,000 to $10,000 on them, and they're all maxed out. And their house is maxed out, and their two cars are maxed out. And their dog is maxed out, and their kids are maxed out. That's unbelievable. I've got one credit card, and month to month we try to pay that crazy thing. I don't know. And I don't know, how did I get started on all that anyway?
Saw a rabbit running.
I guess. Well, let's get back in here. This is more fun. So Daniel says, keep all your stuff. I don't need all your stuff. And I will make the interpretation known to the king. Verse 18, O king, the most high God. Here's our sovereignty again. Who does Daniel live his life for? He's about 85 years old now at this time. He's lived, remember he was taken when he was what? 14, 15 years old, 16? 15, 16 as a teenager. He was taken, ripped away from his parents, from his homeland, from everything that he loved and cherished. He and Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, and I think there was a whole lot more than them. How come only those four are mentioned? In chapter 1, because they stood up. They had made up their minds not to defile themselves with the king's food or the king's dancing girls or anything else that the king had. Instead, they would live their lives in captivity to serve the living God. How do you do that? O king, the most high God. By bringing attention to God, that there is a God. And all of us will answer to him someday. So let's live for him now, so when we get there, he'll say, well done, my faithful servant. And you'll say, it's only because you worked in me, because I was a moron and a horrible sinner most of my life. But praise be to God that he kept working in my heart and kept reminding me to change. O king, the most high God, verse 18, has granted you sovereignty, grandeur, glory, and majesty. He granted it to Nebuchadnezzar and to your father. And because of the grandeur which he bestowed on him, all the peoples, nations, and men of every language feared and trembled before him. Whomever he wished, he killed, and whomever he wished, he spared alive, and whomever he wished, he elevated, and whomever he wished, he humbled. He elevated me, so I can tell you about him. I served him for 50 years, 60 years, 60-something, 65 years. I didn't do the math there. But from the time he was 16 up until not too much earlier than this date right here, about 60 years, I served him. And he was a good man. He was given everything that he had by the sovereignty of God. There it is again. God gave it to him. I like this that he, verse 18, the Most High God granted sovereignty, grandeur, glory, majesty to Nebuchadnezzar, your father, and because of the grandeur bestowed on him. So he goes back to Nebuchadnezzar as being the one that God really worked with. How about Nabonidus and Belshazzar? They don't seem to be included in all this, do they? They aren't being elevated like Nebuchadnezzar was. Verse 20, but when his heart was lifted up in pride, and that was our chapter last week, chapter 4, and his spirit became so proud that he behaved arrogantly, he was deposed from his royal throne, and his glory was taken away from him. Notice it doesn't say taken away from him and given to another, does it? It was taken away from him. Verse 21, and he was driven away from mankind, and his heart was made like that of beasts, and his dwelling place was with the wild donkeys. And he was given grass to eat like cattle, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven, until he recognized that the Most High God is ruler of the realm of mankind, and that he sets over it whomever he wishes. Yet you, his son, his grandson, Belshazzar, you have not humbled your heart, even though you knew all of this. You knew all of this. You think maybe Daniel was his tutor as a boy, and he just totally blew him off? I don't want anything to do with you. I don't want to follow this. I want to go watch the dancing girls, and I want all that the kingdom has to offer, but I don't want to be a head wiser. I don't want to be wise. I just want the stuff. I just want to live immorally and enjoy all that creation has to offer me, but not acknowledge the Creator or live within his boundaries is what I think is going on here. But what he's referring to is what we looked at here last week. Oh, I didn't have it. I'm sorry, I didn't put it in here. Where he is driven out into the palace garden and lives there for 7 years. until he comes to recognize that God is sovereign. Verse 23 goes back to Belshazzar, but you have exalted yourself against the Lord of heaven. How did he do that? How did he lift himself up and exalt himself against the Lord God of heaven?
Well, it says here, and a little bit later down, that he worshipped money.
He worshipped money right in the very beginning. What did he do at this feast when he got good and drunk?
Verse 4.
He brought in the vessels from the temple of God, the gold and silver vessels that were holy vessels used in the priestly service in God's temple. And Nebuchadnezzar had captured all that, brought it all back, and had it in the temples of his God. Well, he brought all that in. They started drinking from him, toasting each other and just acting crazy. So he exalted himself against the Lord by doing that at this feast. Here he goes on to say right here in verse 23. You have brought out the vessels of God's house from before you, and you and your nobles, your wives, and your concubines have been drinking wine from them, and you have praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see, hear, or understand. They're just idols. You've made them with your own hands. Well, look at this pretty one. Isn't this pretty? Look, it even opens up, and it's a fat man laying down, or he's a skinny man standing up. You've got these idols in here. You're praising all your idols made of iron, bronze, gold, wood, stone, but they don't see or hear or understand. But the God in whose hand are your very life breath, your life breath is in God's sovereign hand, and your ways are before him, and yet you do not glorify him. Then the hand was sent from him, and this inscription was written out. Now this is the inscription that was written out. Many, many tekel upharsin. This is the interpretation of the message. Many, God has numbered your kingdom and put an end to it. Tekel, you have been weighed on the scales and found deficient. Perez, your kingdom has been divided and given over to the Medes and the Persians. Upharsin is Perez, which means you've been divided and broken up and given over. Given over to who? The Medes and the Persians, the guys right outside the gates. Then Belshazzar gave orders, and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a necklace of gold around his neck and issued a proclamation concerning him that he had authority as the third ruler in the kingdom. And before you two run, let me show these couple slides here real quick and talk about the handout I gave you. So the fingers show up and right on this wall, and Daniel comes in and interprets it for him. Here's a model chariot from this period under the Persians that conquered them this night. This is all of gold that they found digging over there in the Middle East. This shows the king in all of his glory. The king's there, you know, just kind of, you know, looking out over the peoples, and he's got his chariot tender there. But just incredible wealth and power of possibly Cyrus or one of the other rulers that came after him. These are all in the British Museum, these slides here. This is the Cyrus cylinder. One of the reasons that I said as we started the study, I gave you a handout. We've got two extra biblical references to Cyrus taking over this night and conquering Babylon. This clay cylinder called the Cyrus cylinder, inscribed in Babylonian cuneiform, records Cyrus, the king of Persia's account of his conquest of Babylon and capture of Nabonidus, the last king, Babylonian king, in October of 539 BC. Something I find so interesting about this, he doesn't even reference Belshazzar, this little young whip. He references his dad, who he did battle with, and who finally came out. His dad wasn't here the night that he conquered Babylon. He was away. But after Babylon fell, Nabonidus came and presented himself and humbled himself before Cyrus. So guess what Cyrus did? He gave him a palace. He said, where would you like? Well, I built myself a palace down here to the south. I like it down here. He said, then here's an allowance for you. Go and live there in peace. Don't raise your hand against me. He said, I won't. I'm an old man. You've killed my prideful, arrogant, stupid son. So I won't. And so because he came and humbled himself, Cyrus let him live. Well, this tablet, it's about this big. This is how they recorded their history, like this and on clay tablets. And this has the account that in October of 539 that Cyrus says, I took, he says here, Nabonidus, I took Babylon. Actually, it was Belshazzar, the co-regent, but he doesn't even acknowledge him. He just acknowledges his dad. Here's another shot of it. I found these pictures online. These are new pictures. I had older pictures that weren't near as nice. I was Googling, and I got right into the British Museum. So you can go right into the British Museum now, and they make these pictures available where they never did that before. And you don't even have to pay. And then we have Herodotus. I just find this fascinating. This was Alexander's historian. He was a Greek historian, Herodotus. And Herodotus in his histories talk about the fact he is the world's first historian, apart from Moses and the biblical writers, of course, who recorded history for us, and the Egyptians who recorded history for us. But Herodotus put it in papyrus rolls, and we have his records. We have his accounts. And he, in his account of the fall of Babylon, records that Cyrus, the king of Persia, took the city of Babylon in October of, I didn't put it in here, but in October of 539 BC. Listen to how he says that they did this. The way that they were outside the city walls, right? And Cyrus, and which his general, it could have been Darius, Gubaru. These names could be the same for Cyrus. We're not sure. Or one of his generals. But anyway, one of them sitting outside the walls, hearing all the partying going on inside, and there's no way they're getting in there because there's two walls. It's a two-wall system. They sat out there for a while, and some smart engineer came to him and said, "Oh, King, do you remember when you got so mad at a river over in another place? You got so mad at the river because we couldn't cross it, and you brought troops out, and you had us dig canals off of each side of the river, 180 of them, I think it was, canals. And then at the right time, we busted down the outer walls and all the water went out all those canals that we had made and diverted it around that other city we took." "Yeah," he said, "yeah, I remember that." "Well, we got plenty of troops. We got millions of them here. They're all just sitting around getting fat, eating, waiting to go in there and conquer, which we're never going to get in there to conquer. Why don't we do that? Why don't we divert the river? Let's dig this big trench around this thing. And the tributary of the Euphrates that flows through the middle of the city, we'll just dig a canal around that and divert that, baby. And we'll have troops ready to go from the one end and troops from the other end. And when the water level goes down, we'll get in there. We won't even have to fire a shot." He said, "I love it. I love it. Let's do it." So Herodotus says that they diverted the Euphrates, the tributary of the Euphrates River that ran through the middle of the ancient city, and it was a bloodless victory. They marched in from either side and took them on that night because they were all in a drunken stupor. Absolutely, I just find that this absolutely amazing, guys. So you've got two sources. Cyrus recounts his own record of how he took them, and then you've got this Greek historian Herodotus who doesn't have any axe to grind. And where did he get his history? From the Cyrus cylinder. And probably from other accounts of how they took that. This was contemporary of the time in the 5th century B.C., and I just think this is pretty cool stuff myself. So verse 30 then, I'm sorry guys, I wanted to get that in before they left because I worked hours on that. I've given you this, you can read the full account for yourselves, and that's available online. And I think, yeah, I gave you the webpage that I got this off of at the bottom there. So you can look at the full document if you want. Verse 30, that same night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was slain. So Darius the Mede received the kingdom at about the age of 62. 539 B.C., Daniel's in his 80s at this time. And I love where chapter 6, it seems good to Darius to appoint 120 satraps over the kingdom, that they should be in charge of the whole kingdom. And over them, three commissioners, of whom Daniel was one. So here Daniel is a head commissioner in this brand new kingdom, the Persian, Medes and Persians. And Persia ultimately takes full control and becomes the second great empire of that statue that we studied earlier in Daniel chapter 2. Nebuchadnezzar was the head of gold, wasn't he? And then the breast and top torso, all of silver. That's the Persian Empire, the Medes and the Persians. Cyrus comes to power.
Question.
Yes.
Did the Babylonians ever come back to power again?
No.
That was the absolute
They're done.
Demise.
They're done. Nabonidus, and I think the reason that he mentions Nabonidus in the in the Cyrus cylinder is because Nabonidus comes and bows to him, and we have the record of that in the Cyrus cylinder. If you want to look online, and you can read about that. When Babylon fell, I mean, it was done like that. God prophesied it here, and it says on that same night, on that very night, Belshazzar the king was slain. So Cyrus's troops came in by diverting the river. They marched right in there in a city that was impossible to take, and found them all in a drunken feast. And it seems like in the palace they were drunk and partying. My question is, where was all the guards that should have watched the river, this tributary of the river going down? Why didn't they lock the gates? They had gates off of all these rivers just in case somebody, you know, should hold their nose and come under the wall that way. They had gates to where they couldn't get in, but it was just prophesied by God, and it was all wide open. They dried up the river, and the troops came in from either side under the walls and took them. Just like nothing. And God said it would happen, and it happened. And then Daniel is set in charge again by Cyrus. I think that's pretty interesting. Let me read a little bit of this to you. Soon after Nabonidus was elected to power, the grandson or son in some way, he was connected to Nebuchadnezzar, Nabonidus was. He led his army to Palestine and North Arabia, leaving Belshazzar as co-regent in Babylon. Nabonidus's decision to stay down in Arabia resulted in unpopularity at home as much as from his desire to found a settlement there with exiles from Palestine. So for some reason, Nabonidus was way down in the south in the Arabian Peninsula. We're not sure why he liked it down there, but that's where he was. He liked it down there. And so he left Belshazzar, his son, in charge in Babylon. In Babylon, there was terrible inflation brought about by continuing military expenditures. Boy, does that ring any bells for us, guys? Trillions of dollars for the war effort? Question, are we going to make any difference over there in the Middle East, apart from Israel, who we have been their protector since, 46 or 48? But how about all those Arab countries that surround Israel? We go in and try to democratize those countries, Afghanistan. How's things going there? The opium trade is better than it's ever been. That's true. And God, of course, God is sovereign. That's why I'm not in control and God is. Because he can use all of these things for his glory to win certain of those individuals. But my point was that all the money we throw at them over there, we are not going to change their philosophy and their way of thinking and their commitment to world dominance, being the Muslim Arab forces that they are. But anyway... Well, they control the whole Middle East except for just Israel, that little strip of land that was God's strip of land that he himself will fight for and continue to protect. So Babylon, I was on this point here that Babylon was in real trouble because of their extensive military expenditures. Nabonidus was away from the kingdom, and Belshazzar was in control, and all he was doing was partying and spending money on himself. In building and carrying on. As a result, the inflation rate at the time, from what we can glean from history, was around 50% between 560 and 530 BC, resulting in widespread famine and problems for Babylon. In the last year of Nabonidus, the Babylonian Chronicle, which is also in the British Museum, it's a clay tablet, a larger flat square clay tablet. The Babylonian Chronicle records that idols of the cities of Babylon were brought in as an action of trying to divert impending war by the Persians that were coming. This cylinder, one of four bearing the same text found at the four corners of the ziggurat at Ur, is inscribed in Babylonian cuneiform, and they had a prayer to the moon god Sin, to whom the ziggurat is consecrated. And it mentions Belshazzar, which is the Belshazzar here of Daniel 5, the son of, born of the offspring of the body of my heart, of the moon god Sin. And so it sounds like Belshazzar had this clay tablet made up, four copies of it, and had one put at each corner of the ziggurat, saying that he, Belshazzar, was the son, the firstborn of the offspring of the heart, the body of the moon god Sin. Inscriptions designate Daniel as third ruler in the kingdom. So I think that's interesting too, that on the same document, on the Babylonian Chronicle that's in the British Museum, it seems like Belshazzar or those right after him has Daniel listed as the third ruler of the kingdom, which he mentioned that he would do for him in 529. So somebody carried out this order, and it's on this clay tablet that they found. The clay wasn't even dry on that thing before Cyrus came in and took them that night. But it's just interesting as archaeologists dig around over there and come up with this stuff. And we could go to the British Museum over there in England, and we could look at this tablet. And if we had somebody with us that could read Babylonian ancient cuneiform, they could read that for us and tell you what it says. Cyrus the Great ruled from lived from 559 from 559 to 530. He was the founder of the Achaemenid Persian Empire that continued for two centuries after, until the time of Alexander the Great, who took over in 331 BC. Alexander the Great is what? The third kingdom on that statue, isn't he? We went from gold, the head of gold, to silver, to bronze, and that's the picture of Alexander. Alexander is a fabulous study. We've studied him before. He came to power in 331 BC, and within 10 years, by 321, he had taken the whole known world of his day and conquered it, and then he died in 10 years. Cyrus inherited the throne of Anshan in Greece after unifying the Persian peoples. He attacked his father-in-law, the weak and corrupt Astyages, the Midian general Harpagus. Well, I won't read all this stuff. It'll drive you crazy. Cyrus succeeded in welding the Medes and the Persians into a unified nation. Moving swiftly to the west, he absorbed all the Median territories in Asia Minor and came to Croesus, the fabulously wealthy king of Lydia, and he refused to recognize the sovereignty of the Medes and Persians, so Cyrus defeated him in battle and took over his empire. 7 years later, he was ready to launch his great assault against Babylon. So in 546, he took over Lydia, which was up in the north. He took over that great kingdom and then came down and eventually, as we're reading here, came against Babylon. The Mede and the Persian invasion in the year of 539, during the previous 14 years before 539, the Medes and the Persians had been doing battle against Nabonidus, the king, and they had not so much as visited the capital city in Babylon because of Nabonidus was able to resist them. Toward the end of September, the armies of Cyrus, under the able command of Gubaru, the district governor of Gudium, attacked Opus on the Tigris River, was just north of Babylon, and this gave the Persians control of the vast canal systems of Babylon. And on the night of October 10th, Nabonidus fled, and Herodotus describes how 2 days later, on October 12th, 539 BC, Gubaru's Persian troops were able to enter Babylon without a battle by ingeniously diverting the river Euphrates into a canal upper river so that the water level dropped, so that the water was up to just a man's thigh level, and he had had his Cyrus had his troops stationed at both ends of the river of the canal that came into the city of Babylon, and they were able, once they diverted the floodwaters, they were able to march in from both ends, and the flood defenses were useless and enabled the invaders to march through the riverbed to enter in that night and conquer Belshazzar and take Babylon. And so here, I've tried to give you that. You can read, if you just Google, you can Google this and come up with millions of web pages, but this one here I gave you I thought was a real good one about Herodotus. But I just think it's interesting. Questions on this? Again, who is sovereign? And again, we've been developing this chapter 2, chapter 3, chapter 4, 5, 6, and 7 were in a chiasm, weren't they? What happened in chapter 2? I'm sorry?
Changed languages.
Yeah, they went to Aramaic instead of Hebrew, which the book opened with introduction in chapter 1. But in chapter 2, what's the major thing in chapter 2? You remember? It's going to be the same thing in chapter 7.
The dream,
the statue of the four world empires. Here it's a statue and here it's four wild animals, isn't it? Because the Gentiles will become worse and worse and worse, and they're depicted as wild animals. Chapters 3 and 6, what happens in 3?
Fiery furnace.
Chapter 6, next week, Daniel in the lion's den, right? Is God able to protect his own? And they stand for God again. O king, we've considered carefully your decree. We are not going to bow down and worship the image of the beast. This is a foreshadow of all the way at the end in the book of Revelation, isn't it? And the final Gentile world ruler who will make an image to himself and demand that all peoples, all nations, all tongues worship the beast. That's in the book of Revelation. That's the final Gentile ruler. So these two chapters are the same. And these two chapters are highlighting what? Chapter 4, we saw last week.
Change of the king, really.
It was...
Nebuchadnezzar dies there, or comes back after the...
Well, chapter 4 was him last week exalting himself in pride and God humbling him, right? How about his grandson now, Belshazzar, the last ruler of Babylon? Filled with pride, arrogance, and blasphemy against the God of heaven. So the sovereignty of God... And all through these chapters, Daniel is reiterating, God, the Lord of hosts, is in charge. You need to acknowledge him. And Nebuchadnezzar did acknowledge him with a little bit of gentle persuasion. 7 years living out like a wild animal. So this is what we call a chiasm, isn't it? And chi is the Greek letter, and it looks like an X, doesn't it? And so this is a literary device, and I've talked to you about this. I love chiasms. I look for them as I read the scriptures now. This is something I was alerted to in seminary. I didn't know what in the world a chi was. Couldn't have told you. But now the Bible is just filled with these, especially the Old Testament. And it's a literary device that was used to emphasize this truth is repeated down here coming out. This truth is repeated down here. And the center of the chiasm is always the most important, isn't it? It's a parallel device, literary parallelism. It's emphasizing truths that the author wants to get across to you. What's he getting across here? Who's in charge? God's in charge. God is sovereign. And I think these first seven chapters are just, to me, they're just fabulous. And then next week we'll look at Daniel in the lion's den. A brand new ruler comes to town, and how about all the other men that Cyrus is surrounded by? They see that Cyrus really likes this guy named Daniel, this old man that was supposedly in charge in Babylon. He was a head wiser. We don't like head wisers. We want Budweiser. And so they try to take him out, don't they? And the thing that I love about next week as we study this account of chapter 6, for those of you that read ahead, is they studied Daniel's life and they tried to find fault with him. Could they find fault with Daniel? So we can't find any fault with him. So we're going to have to come up with something really devious. We have to make a royal decree that unless we get him in his worship, no man shall pray to his God during this certain time. If he does, he'll be thrown into a den of lions and ripped to pieces. So they get the king to pass this legislation, and he signs it. And then they go straight to Daniel's house and just wait for him to get home. And he opens his windows, and morning, noon, and night, what's he do? He goes home and he prays towards Jerusalem for the peace of, and restoration of God's people, for the glory of God Almighty. And I'm sure he knew that those guys were down there just waiting to take him into custody, and they do. But again, he's thrown into a den of lions, and just like chapter 3, the three young men were thrown into a fiery furnace. Is God able to deliver? Oh yeah, he can deliver. But even if he doesn't choose to deliver us, we're going to worship him because we'll be delivered in the end. We get to go be with him. He created us, and we will serve him all the days of our life. Lots of practical applications in these chapters for you and I. Have we determined in our hearts to serve him and serve him only, to tell people about him? And that's difficult to do sometimes, isn't it? We're fearful. We don't like rejection. You know, maybe we've tried it one time. We've shared with somebody, and they laughed at us or told us to get lost or whatever. and we haven't done it again. Well, we need to ask God to give us courage, so we'll share again. Give us opportunities to share. Yesterday I had the guy come out and pumped out my septic, and I shared the Lord with him. And he's a young fella, and his dad and granddad own the company. And it's just interesting just to get to talk with people and to break the ice. They own Borman Septic. And this young fella, his name's Matt, he was the head line manager for Stubblefield up there for Reliable Lexus and BMW and all that. He was the head manager of all the service department. And I said, so you think driving this sewage truck and pumping doesn't have quite the pressure of that job? He said, oh man, you want to hear about pressure? He said, I can tell you about pressure. I'm trying to run that outfit up there. He said, I had enough of it. But here he's got a big college degree and he did all that. And so then I gave him a card and invited him to come to church. And he told me, he said, well, yeah, he said, maybe I'll do that. So then he started giving me a little testimony. He was raised in the Baptist church all of his life. And as a kid, he fell away and just lived a horrible life of sin. But now he's come back to the Lord and he's given his life back to the Lord. And I said, well, that's who I'm looking for. I'm looking for guys just like you. Why don't you come? So I don't know if he'll come or not, but just take that opportunity to talk about the things of Christ. That's what Daniel did. What's the first thing he did when they brought him in here? Oh, King, the Most High God, he rules. And your grandfather confessed that, but you and your old man never got it right. And that's why you're in the fix you're in now. You've been deposed. It's all over for you. God's raised up Cyrus. And I love these accounts as you read through here. Just as you put the chronology together, that 150, 160 years earlier, Isaiah the prophet prophesied about the coming of Cyrus before he was ever born. That's pretty good stuff.